Afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. It is a great privilege and a great pleasure to be with you this afternoon and to have been invited to address you on this particular topic. You should have in front of you a little leaflet with the title on it, Jacob Genetics and Jurassic Park. When I was invited along, I was advised that slides weren't a good idea because of the layout of the hall. And I have taken that advice, and now seeing the layout for myself, I think that was a wise decision. But it's a sort of talk that would be helpful to have some illustrations to go along. So I have a few illustrations with me, one of them being the sheet that you have in front of you. And there will be some other illustrations to help us think through quite a complex topic this afternoon. It's an important issue as we approach the end of the 20th century. And a lot of work that's been done in the last 6 months to a year has shattered some of our well-held beliefs of genetics. And it's very, very important that Christian men and women understand the discipline and understand the background to what is happening in genetics at the moment. As pastors and as teachers and preachers, many of you will already have encountered in your congregations problems relating to genetics. Perhaps you have already met with young couples or their parents or even their grandparents where the young couple is now trying to start a family having problems. And the more recent techniques such as IVF, in vitro fertilization, are starting to be offered to them as a way out of their predicament. As a pastor, you may well be called upon to give your Christian understanding of what is involved in that kind of situation. Other young people who have successfully conceived in a pregnancy may be facing another difficult situation where the result of a fetal screening test is not very good as far as the prognosis of the fetus is concerned. What should they do about it? And what are the Christian dilemmas that they face? These are all vitally important questions that people are facing today. And so this afternoon, we'd like to discuss and broach the subject, which is now being increasingly recognized as a discipline in its own right in various universities throughout the world, and that is the subject of bioethics. Now, I have given a talk along these lines on two previous occasions. On the last occasion, it was in my own church to the Bible Hour. And the Bible Hour attracts quite a wide age range of people along. I'm sure you've been in a situation where you're never too sure how well a talk or a presentation is going to be received. It may be well received or otherwise. But sometimes we're also in the situation where people come up to you at the end of the talk and you're not too sure what the actual meaning is. Are they complimenting you or not? But I assure you that in this particular occasion, an elderly lady was sitting right in front of me for the hour that I was talking, and she was taking copious notes. At the end of the meeting, she leaned forward, looked me straight in the face, and she said, "You know, if that had come on the telly, I would have switched that off." Now, I know what I would like to take out of that. But I think what she was trying to convey was that it's a subject that perhaps filled her with dread, that she feared what she might be hearing about, that she didn't feel that she could cope with understanding. And yet she sat through, and I think, I hope at the end of the day, she did enjoy the presentation. When I was first asked to give a talk on bioethics, I really had to admit that I didn't know very much about the subject at all. And so the first research that I did was that I asked some of my scientific and medical colleagues in the Western Infirmary what their understanding of the term bioethics means. Now, at this morning's talk, there was various mention made of people learning English. Coming from Glasgow, I have done my best to do the same. But there's a lovely word in the Scottish language, not necessarily the English language, but if you ask, and my experience, if you ask a medic or a scientist in the Western, what their understanding of the word bioethics means, you get a perfect description of the word glacket comes to mind. The best that could be elicited in some situations was some sort of incoherent mumblings about Dolly at the end of the day. And we will touch on the subject of Dolly later this afternoon. But what I'd like to do is divide the talk into three main sections. Under the section Jacob, I'd like to look at some of the history of genetics. Under genetics, we'll look at some basic genetics, which will hopefully help us to understand the science of cloning as we get later in the afternoon. The reason that I didn't know very much about bioethics is that I'm a product of a bygone era. When I did my PhD and finished it in 1979, during the write-up, I had to do some statistical calculations. And in 1979, in the Belvedere Hospital, I had access to a handheld calculator. It was the best that we could have at that time. It had an 8-digit display. And it took me half an hour, including writing bits down on a piece of paper, to work out one statistical calculation. Just before I finished my PhD, I'd actually moved to the Western. And there I discovered they had a computer. Now, I use the term loosely. It was a black box with the name Hewlett-Packard written on it. That made it a computer. It had a memory capacity of 1K. That's techno speak. 1K. It was a fairly sophisticated computer. But the maintenance contract on that computer for 1 year, just to keep the thing sane, was £1,000 to keep it going. These days, you can get a great deal of change out of £1,000 and have a computer which would knock spots off this thing way back in 1979. I have to admit that I recalculated all my statistics on this computer and discovered that 90% of them were wrong. Progress has been made in many fields of science, not just in computing, but certainly in genetics and in medicine, and here we enter the difficult minefield of bioethics. Now, it was made clear to me about a year or so ago just how far back in time we've started to grapple with genetic issues, because about a year ago I was taking a small group in the Sunday school in St. David's, and I was trying to explain the life and times of Jacob. And as a geneticist, although I'd heard these stories in my own young days in the Sunday school, as a geneticist, when I came across this particular passage about Jacob, it was really, really interesting. And so I think it's only appropriate that my first visual aid today comes from the Bible itself. And in Genesis chapter 30 at 32, we read of Jacob and the various sheep and goats that he starts to develop. If you'd like to follow it with me, reading from verse 32, he says, "Today I will go over your flocks," this was Laban's flocks, "and pick out from them every black lamb and all the brindled and the spotted goats, and they shall be my wages. This is a fair offer, and it will be to my own disadvantage later on when we come to settle my wages. Every goat amongst mine that is not spotted or brindled, and every lamb that's not black will have been stolen." Laban said, "Agreed. Let it be as you have said." But that day he removed the he-goats that were striped and brindled, and all the spotted and brindled she-goats, and that had any white on them, and every ram that was black, and he handed them over to his sons. And then he put a distance of 3 days' journey between himself and Jacob. That was a fascinating part. He put a distance of 3 days' journey between them. Clearly what was happening here, that was a very early attempt at an experiment in animal breeding. Now, how much Jacob himself understood of what he was doing, I don't know. But he was following God's command to him. He was trusting that God would tell him what to do. And in a dream, God had told him to do just that. And by putting a journey, a 3 days journey, between the ones that he had selected and the remaining part of Laban's flock, there could be no more genetic interaction between the two flocks. Many people since then have attempted to do the same kind of genetic experiments, often not as successfully as Jacob, because we read that Jacob's flocks flourished, they multiplied, and he became very wealthy, and he produced a very strong breed of goat and sheep. Many people have struggled with animal genetics, with plant genetics. It has taken them years to cross-fertilize, etc., and often their experiments have failed. And for many, many centuries, people did not fully understand the reason for the success or failure of their genetic experiments. We owe a great deal to the position that we are in genetics today as a result of my second illustration. We are at this point in time because of a brown bag. I give you, ladies and gentlemen, a can of garden peas. Garden peas were a very, very important part of an experiment which took place way back in the 1860s, 1870s. An Austrian monk called Gregor Mendel gave a completely new idea to genetics. And he wanted to find out why different types of pea plants were growing successfully in the monastery garden. To understand the significance of what Gregor Mendel did here, I'd like to turn your attention to the sheet in front of you. Inside, I'll try and go over what Gregor Mendel basically did. The third page here with the dark and the light colored flowers, this top little diagram. Gregor Mendel, first of all, took a completely new approach to his study. There were a lot of preconceived ideas about what was happening, but Gregor Mendel stood back from all of that, and he focused entirely on what he was trying to achieve. And the first thing that he did was that he selected garden peas. Now, whether this was intuition or just luck, we don't know. But it was vitally important that he did select garden peas, because garden peas happen to have an important attribute. The petals of the peas, the flower, cover the male and female components of the flower, and it protects them against outside influence. If he hadn't had that ability, his experiments may have been upset, and the results wouldn't have made so much sense to him. But he persisted with garden peas. And basically, they produced two types of colour of flower, dark purple and white flowers. And that's what you've got at the very top there. He made sure that he was selecting, first of all, only pea plants that always gave white flowers. Always gave white flowers. He kept them there. And always kept a separate one that always gave purple flowers over here. Right, never reverted back to white or any intermediate shade. White and purple. Knowing that, he then crossed them. He took some pollen from white, gave it to purple. Pollen from purple, gave it to white. And he grew up the seeds from the first generation. What would he find? Well, he found that all the flowers were purple. Now, that was very important. They were all purple. Not a shade of purple, not less purple, but purple. White and purple produced purple, and only purple. Now, it's important that he did one further thing. He then allowed this generation to self-pollinate and produced a second generation. If he hadn't done that, he wouldn't have understood what was happening here. Remember, nobody knew anything about genetics until this point. They were dealing with a situation where they thought they were dealing with mixing colours as if you would mix paint. If you mix, say, blue and yellow paint, you will get green paint. You'll never get back to blue or yellow again. And if genetics worked like that, say you had a blue parakeet and a yellow parakeet and mated them, They would get a green parakeet eventually. And eventually, through time, all parakeets would be green. But that doesn't happen. And it didn't happen in Mendel's experiment either with his coloured flowers. Because when he went to the second generation, suddenly he started to get white flowers back again. Now, how could this be? Where had the white flowers gone at the first part, the first generation? Well, the ability to make the white flowers was still there. It was still there, but it was masked by a dominant gene. Something was still there, but something more powerful was acting upon it, producing purple flowers. And the white ability, although it was there, could not be made manifest until the second generation. Now, what happens is that all living things, they've got two copies of each gene, one from the father, one from the mother. If you look at the little letters underneath the top part, you've got a capital R and a capital R for the dark purple. That means that these are the genes from the mother and father, both make purple flowers. Whereas from the white, little r means that it's recessive gene. It makes the white flowers, both from mother and father. When you cross those, all you can get are big R, small r genotypes. In other words, the big R dominates the small r. The purple gene dominates the white. But the small white gene is still there. And when you recross that, then you have the possibility of four results. Big R, both producing purple. Two possibilities of purple and white, again we know producing purple. And suddenly the opportunity to have small r, white genes coming back to produce the white. What Mendel was discovered here was that we were dealing with some physical entity in genetics that was not mixed down like paint, but retained its ability to conserve itself through generations. He didn't call it a gene at that point, but that's what he was discovering. He was discovering genes. It gets a bit more complicated because he went on and he tried to cross two different abilities. He had a yellow and round pea and a plant that made a green and wrinkled pea. Now, that's roundness or wrinkled, green or yellow. Two different abilities. And through various crosses, he ends up with, again, a 4-to-1 split. But notice the dark ones, the green ones. Although he started off with a green and wrinkled, he doesn't end up with four green and wrinkled. He only ends up with one green wrinkled, three green smooth. There are three other wrinkles there in the proportion 4-to-1. And what this experiment showed him was that the individual genes segregated quite separately. So this physical entity, the gene, each gene was quite separate and could start mixing itself round from one generation to another, mating male and female. And you get random proliferation of the various traits. Now, that's getting kind of heavy. If you start to go on to polygenetic diseases, for example, cancer or high blood pressure, coronary heart disease, you are dealing with very, very complex diseases. I've been looking at hypertension for 20 years, and I don't understand it. So it's very, very complex, the number of different genes involved in the hypertension aspect of things, for example. Now, Gregor Mendel's experiments lay forgotten for a good number of years until the beginning of the 1900s. And then attention once more turned to heredity. What was causing this heritable component? Well, it seemed to be residing in chromosomes, which again had been discovered by that time. If you go back to page 1, a description or a depiction of chromosomes at the bottom of the front page. All of us sitting here today have 23 pairs of chromosomes. And if you're a male, you'll have an X and a Y chromosome. The tiny wee one at the bottom is the Y chromosome. That specifically, maleness is confirmed by that. If you are a lady, You will not have the Y chromosome, you'll have two X chromosomes, but you will have 23 pairs of chromosomes. Chromosomes have been discovered by the early 1900s, and chromosomes have two major components, protein and nucleic acid, DNA. And a lot of people initially thought that it was the protein which was the genetic component. This is where the genes lay, they assumed to begin with. They assumed that because DNA itself was extremely simple. It was made up of only four different substances, the four genetic bases. And yet we were beginning to realize that proteins, very complex proteins, your protein that makes your hair or eye color, skin texture or whatever, they were composed of 23 different amino acids. And the trick was to try and find some way of finding a code that could code for each individual amino acid. Four nucleic acids just didn't seem to be sufficient to code for 23 amino acids. So what was the idea here? Well, some very clever experiments were conducted behind the scenes, which started to point the finger not at the proteins for the heredity, but actually at the DNA. And eventually, of course, most of you will realize the experiments done in 1953 by Watson and Crick. And what they came up with was a double helical idea of what DNA is. DNA, two strands intertwined in a double helix. And this was vitally important understanding that led us on to explain more about how genetics actually works. But it still didn't explain what the code was. We needed to know the code. How can four nucleic acid bases code for 23 amino acids? Obviously, if you use one nucleic acid, you could only code for four amino acids. It's no use. What happens if you use a combination of two bases? Well, you would get 4 to the power 2. 4 times 4, 16. You're still 7 short. That doesn't work either. But what happens if you use three bases as the basis of the code? A triplet code. There you get 4 cubed. That comes to 64. Slightly too many. But that's actually what happens. The DNA is read in a series of threes, the triplet code. And the triplet code has these days been unraveled. You probably can't see it from where you're sitting. It doesn't matter. Suffice to say that it has been unraveled. And the explanation why there are 64 codes and only 23 amino acids is that some amino acids are coded for by more than one code. And in fact, three of the codes tell the protein to stop being made. They're stop signals. That's the code of life. And ladies and gentlemen, that code of life, the same code, is found throughout the known world, from bacteria right through to you and I. Now, you can read into that what you like, but I see great design in that from the one creator. I could be wrong, but that's the way I see that. Others disagree with me on that one, however. Okay, so we've got a code. Now we've got the DNA. What can we do with it? Well, what can we do with DNA? There's a lot we can do with DNA these days. What does it all mean? Every cell in our bodies, and we are composed of millions of cells, each cell in our bodies has a nucleus, apart from one cell, which I'll come on to in a moment. All cells in our bodies have a nucleus composed of DNA. And that DNA acts as a type of computer, regulating our bodies, telling our bodies what to make and how much proteins of each type to make. We know what the code is. Can we extract DNA and deal with it? Well, we can. How do we extract DNA? Well, we've got various options open to us. We could remove the patient's liver and extract the DNA from that. You could do that. But at the end of the day, if you had a genetic result and the patient had no liver, there would be little point in doing that. So we need to find something a bit more accessible. And what we've found that we can use are blood samples. We can take blood samples. Now, if you take a blood sample and you put it in a centrifuge and spin it down, you'll find that fits into three different components. At the top, there's a yellow sort of straw coloured liquid called plasma. It contains lots of proteins and antibodies and lots of things like that. It does not contain any DNA. But half of it is red blood cells. Now guess which cell in the body does not contain any DNA? Yeah, it's the red blood cell, so that's no use to us either. But we're fortunate in that just between the two, there's a little white layer called the buffy coat, and that's the white blood cells. They're the white blood cells in there. We can extract DNA from that. So, next demonstration. We need to collect some blood. Now, what we need here, I've lost the needle. What we need here, it's not a rusty one, it's all right. That's actually quite a sharp one. Do we have any, you know, when it gets to this point in the talk, everybody thinks they've lost a £5 note. In their own. I don't think we need that. In good old Blue Peter tradition, I have one I prepared earlier. Now this, at great sacrifice to myself, I donated some blood on Friday, and I started to prepare some DNA. It takes 2 days to prepare the DNA. The first thing is you've got to break up the red blood cells. They're no use to us. So we smash those up, and then we extract the proteins out, and we are left with a colourless fluid. Now, hopefully in there, is some DNA. This is something you should never, ever do at a demonstration, is try something like this. What I'll try to do is, with a little pipette, show you, first of all, that it's just a liquid. Yep, it just drips in. It's just a liquid. Trust me, I'm a doctor. What we have to do at the final stage is add a liquid which will take all the water out of the DNA. All right? When we take the water out, we dehydrate it, and hopefully the DNA should fall out of solution. Did you hear that? Fall out of solution. So we'll try it and see. Yes, it has actually worked. Can you see it at the back row? It has worked perfectly down here. There is if I can get a hold of part of it. In there, there's a long strand. You see it at the end there? Okay, that's DNA. Human DNA, my DNA. Now, if the science of Jurassic Park's concerned, you could clone millions of me out of that. You probably wouldn't want to, but we'll come on to that later. Okay, so there's DNA in there. Now that we've got DNA, what can we do with it? There's a great deal we can do with it. We can use this stuff. You can do this in your kitchen at home if you want to. The trouble is persuading a wife you're allowed to do this. We can use a jelly-like substance, all right, to separate out different sizes of DNA. And what we do is we run it in a little cell like this. We connect it up to a voltage. And DNA happens to have a negative charge on it. And if you connect it up to an electric field, it tries to go towards the positive anode. It tries to go down through the gel. As it goes through the gel, we actually use a substance called agarose, but it's very similar to gelatin. Because gelatin sets, and it's got a particular matrix structure in it. There are tiny microscopic holes in the gelatin. And if you put DNA in at the top here and ask it to run down to the bottom, it tries to fight its way through the holes. Small bits of DNA obviously manage to get through the holes easier and therefore go further in a set time than large pieces of DNA which get stuck. And so you separate out your DNA on the basis of size. And at the end of the day, you can stain the DNA and you'll get something that looks like this. So there are two experiments on here. On the on the right-hand panel, the thing here with all the bands, that's a known ladder of DNA. We know the size of each one of these bands. Okay, that gives us a sort of map to see what we're talking about. What we don't know before we do the experiment is what size of band we're going to get in the next two. Forget the one beyond the dotted line just now. Don't forget this one just now. Do you see the difference between the negative and the positive? One has got two bands and the other one has got three bands. This is an experiment that I do diagnostically in the Western. There are two centres in Britain that do this particular technique. And it's a technique to diagnose a particular, very rare kind of high blood pressure in which the patient has a third gene which causes their high blood pressure. And we see it very dramatically either as two genes, whether normal, or three genes that are affected. Very simple, but very efficient. There's another thing you can do, another way. There's a whole lot of things you can do. You can again run your ladder so that you know where you are, your street map. And if you know what type of, what the code is in the area you're interested in, you can hit it with an enzyme which cuts that particular piece of DNA. Sometimes it cuts when the patient is normal, and you would get two bands out. If you add up the size of those, you should get the size of the large band. All right? Sometimes it cuts because the patient is abnormal. But again, it's a physical marker for a particular genetic problem. These are some of the things that we can do with DNA. But remember that it's 23 different chromosomes that we're dealing with in the human. And on those 23 different chromosomes, there is a total of 6,000 million bases. Now, that's a lot of DNA to try and cope with. And we need to try and understand all of that. And we're nowhere near understanding what all of that does at the moment. But we're starting to look at it. We're starting to look at it in a great worldwide collaboration called the Human Genome Project. I'm sure some of you have heard about it. We're trying to sequence the entire 6,000 million bases of the human DNA. I was looking at their website just a couple of days ago before I came here preparing my talk and discovered they are now more than halfway through the allotted time of 15 years. It's going to cost something like $3 billion to do it. It's a biological equivalent of putting a man on the moon. It is so complex. We're more now than halfway through it, and they have only sequenced 7% of the human genome. 7%. But we will continue, and hopefully, eventually, we'll understand the code of the entire human genome. Now, what can we do with that information? Well, there's a lot we can do with it, but it produces itself some very great problems. If we can tell you what genetic abnormalities you have in your body, should we also tell the insurance companies what genetic abnormalities you have in your body? If you know something the insurance companies know, you have the advantage. And the insurance companies don't like that. All right? But is it their right to know your genetic makeup? First problem. With the techniques that we have, with the genetics that we can do, we can go into other bioethical fields. And there have been great debates in the field of reproductive medicine. What problems are there there? Well, they're not new. Way back in the 1960s with the development of the birth control pill, suddenly you had a situation where people could control their own bodies to a much greater extent. And a great debate ranged upon whether it was the right of the fetus or the right of the woman that should prevail. The situation has become even more complex since 1990 because the French pharmaceutical company, came up with an abortion tablet, RU486. It makes it even easier to induce an abortion. and it's still awaiting approval from the Food and Drug Administration in the United States, but that technology exists now and gives people great concerns about how it will be used in the future. I've already mentioned the possibility or the problems associated with people who can't have a family and might be resort to in vitro fertilization. In vitro fertilization is now about 20 years old, but it's becoming routine. The problem with it is that there are difficulties behind the scenes. If you're going to do something like in vitro fertilization, you need to take some eggs from the woman's ovaries, and you mix it with the male sperm outside the body, and then you reimplant. Now, it's a costly technique. And so what they do to avoid, it's not always 100% successful either. And so to avoid doing it two and three times, they take a few eggs out and they mix all of them with sperm and they'll put up to three back in. And not all of them will implant and not all will go to term. But what about the other ones that you've taken out and stored in a freezer? What do you do with those? What do you do with those when the parents are older and die? What do you do with the embryos themselves? Difficult problem. We're also discovering that women of advanced years can also give birth to viable children. A 63-year-old lady lied to a University of Southern California reproduction clinic and was able to successfully carry a child to term, giving birth last September to a perfectly normal baby. Now, there was a storm of protest about this for a wee while. Because she was so old, she was unlikely to survive much longer than the adolescence of the child. But, they said, you don't have any qualms when it's an elderly father that fathers a child. Is that a different story? It's a problem. These days we can also produce large families by giving them fertility treatment. And just fairly recently in Iowa, a situation arose where seven fetuses all implanted in a woman's uterus and started to develop. She decided not to, as they say, selectively reduce the number, but she carried all seven to term. And she gave birth to seven healthy children. Now, the mayor, or the governor of Iowa, donated a house, and a food company donated a year's worth of baby food to this particular person. But the medical bills for the first year alone are likely to exceed $5 million to help this family. Now, Glasgow Corporation just couldn't afford that sort of thing. These are some of the difficulties that arise. We have fetal tissue stored in laboratories. Should we be using those for research and transplantation? We've got problems I also mentioned at the beginning where you can diagnose through genetic testing abnormalities of the fetus at a very early stage. Unfortunately, we stand at a very difficult point in human history. Genetics has improved as far as the diagnosis of many conditions is concerned, but not the treatment. And so the only treatment, in inverted commas, that is open to someone is to abort the fetus. A very difficult decision to make. But if you have the choice, for example, in, say, Huntington's chorea, where you've got a known family history, and that person could end up suffering and dying at a very early age, and you can detect that as at a fetal level, what do you do? Do you terminate that pregnancy then, that human being's life at that point, and save them the suffering to come? These are extremely difficult issues that bioethics is trying to address. And of course, the most recent addition to the bioethical repertoire has been the issue of cloning. Of what is cloning all about? Well, now that you've got some basic genetic information at your fingertips, we can go on and describe what cloning is all about. In one sense, I've been cloning organisms for many, many years. Anybody actually sitting here that has baked a loaf of bread or made a pizza with a yeast dough has cloned an organism, because that's how yeast reproduce. They clone themselves. They bud off a new component with exactly the same DNA in it as the original. It's a clone. Bacteria, simple organisms, well, relatively simple organisms, again, divide into two, and each one has the same information as the original. They clone themselves. But when it comes to the higher organisms, it's a different situation. Remember, I directed your attention to the front page, the 23 chromosomes, half of them from the father and half of them from your mother. Okay? That's not cloning. Right? That's a fertilization procedure and random mixing of genes to produce you as a unique individual. A unique individual. What does cloning involve? Well, years ago when I worked at Belvedere, I used to go to the abattoir every so often, and I would collect a freshly killed calf's kidney, because I needed to grow up some viruses. And the way I would do that was to grow the viruses on a tissue culture plate. And I needed living cells, kidney cells, to grow and infect with the virus. As I grew those cells, they would grow on the plate, they would make the plate confluent, and I would split them. And I could continue doing that perhaps 6, 7, 8 times. But eventually, these cells would die. Eventually, they would die. Also, they were kidney cells. And they were always kidney cells. No matter what I did to them, they would remain kidney cells. And for years, we believed that once a kidney cell, always a kidney cell. Once a cell on your finger, always a cell on your finger. And why would that be so? Well, at the moment of fertilization, an embryo is produced, and the cell divides into 2, and then into 4, and then into 8. We call it the blastocyst. Something then remarkable happens, which we are only beginning to learn the answers to. A situation or a function called differentiation. Your parents, your mother and your father, gave you half of your set of chromosomes. And all the genes that make you were in that initial cell, that diploid cell with 2 sets of chromosomes. All the information's there. And all the information is in every cell of your body, just like the white flowers back in Mendel's time, or the blue flowers in Mendel's time. The white information was still there, but it wasn't being made manifest in that flower. All the information is in each cell of your body that makes you, you. But a kidney cell doesn't need to know how to make a fingernail. It is absolutely no use to it. So the genes that make a fingernail in the kidney cell is switched off. A finger doesn't need to know how to filter urine. So that information is switched off. This process of differentiation begins at a very early stage in the fertilized egg. And for many, many years, geneticists believed that you could never turn the clock back. You could never take a differentiated cell, although it contained all the information, and go back in time. But the experiments that took place in Edinburgh about a year ago in Ian Wilmot's group started to show differently. What did Ian do? He took a normal mammary cell from an adult sheep, and he starved that cell. It was differentiated into a mammary cell, and he starved it. He denied it certain essential elements, growth nutrients, and starved it. And the cells went into a sort of dormant phase. And in this dormant phase, the cell somehow started to deprogram itself. He then fused that starved cell with an egg cell which had had its nucleus removed. It remained intact as far as the egg side of things, the cytoplasm, all the jelly-like stuff was concerned. But he took the nucleus out, okay, its own half, its own chromosomes, okay, that component, all the DNA out. And he put the starved cell in. So he was giving the DNA from the starved cell with all its genes there into this egg. And he re-implanted it into a sheep. In fact, he did 277 cell fusions. And he implanted it into sheep. 29 began growing. 277, he put the DNA back in. Of those, he started to grow up in a test tube. 29 started growing. He put all of those into 13 sheep. And eventually, one lamb was born. And that lamb's name was Dolly. All right? It's a success rate which is extremely low, but very important. Was not the normal result of a union of a male and female. Because her DNA was exactly the same as the mammary cell taken from the other sheep's uterus. It's that cell which has been de-differentiated back in to an embryo and grown up. So Dolly is genetically identical to the cell that was removed from the other sheep. She is a clone of the other sheep. Why is this so important? Why should we need to do anything like this? Why clone anything? Well, it's all to do with technology advancement. And it's to do with money, guess, believe it or not. We can, at the moment, without Dolly, produce human proteins in tissue culture cells. It takes a long time to do it. You have to inject the cell that makes, say, insulin into a DNA that makes insulin into a cell and grow it up. And then you can grow it up in vast quantities. But when these cells die, you've got to go back to the laboratory and try and do it all over again. It takes time and effort and money. But just imagine you could get a sheep out grazing in the field that you knew made insulin, or a cow grazing in the field, and you went and milked that cow, and the insulin was in the milk. Gallons of this stuff. Wouldn't that be wonderful? And that's what they're starting to do. They can make transgenic animals. You can make animals produce human proteins. All right. What about the cloning aspect? Well, again, it's hit or miss to make an animal to make a human protein. But if you go to the cloning stage and you insert the gene into an egg and you grow up a whole lot of eggs in a petri dish and test to make sure that you've successfully done that, you can put most of them in a freezer and inject one into a sheep and grow up a new sheep or a new cow. And when that animal dies, you go back to your freezer and take out the next egg, which you know works, and make up an animal. All right? That's the potential of cloning. It's going to save an incredible amount of money, and it could be very beneficial to have insulin on tap, interferon on tap. These are the promises for the future. Tremendous advances. What about the pitfalls and problems? Well, maybe you feel comfortable. Maybe you don't feel comfortable. But maybe you do feel comfortable with the idea of being able to do that with animals. With what you can do with animals, you can transfer to humans. And this is where it becomes very, very difficult. What do you do when it comes to a human? Should we be cloning humans? Why would we want to clone a human? Are there any benefits to be derived from it? Well, a lot of us might have dicky ticker, heart complaint. You might have a kidney problem later in life. Where are you going to get another kidney from? If you're lucky enough to have a twin, which is a natural clone, it contains the same DNA idea as you, you might be lucky enough that your twin would donate a kidney. You might be lucky enough to find a kidney donor which matches you, but that's a problem, getting the right match, because your body would recognize it as foreign otherwise and reject it. But say, for example, you had the ability to clone a bit of your body, and you could clone up a kidney and keep it in cold storage. until you needed a kidney. That's the possibility that cloning produces. But how do you clone an organ? And at the moment, we don't know how we can clone an organ on its own. We need to think in terms of cloning some sort of mindless wonder that's got all the organs but no brain. It's starting to sound like science fiction. At the moment, most of it is. I hasten to say that. At the moment, most of it is. But the potential and the theory now exists. The science of Jurassic Park is becoming more and more likely, but we're not there yet. What other problems could there be? Well, what about the situation where a mother and father lose their dearest child in a car accident? Should they be allowed to clone another identical child? They'll be identical in genetics, but they won't be the same person. They won't be identical in environment. There'll be a difference there. They're going to be disappointed. Sometimes it gets to the ridiculous stage. You've got all these people wanting to clone Elvis. Pity help us if they ever succeed in doing that. But you could clone Elvis if you got an intact piece of DNA from Elvis somewhere. Cloning. It's a new idea. The possibilities are endless. I was up last night until midnight waiting to see the result of the debate in Channel 4 on cloning. And 88% of those who phoned in were against human cloning. 12% were in favour. There is a small but increasingly vociferous group backing human cloning right along the line. Dolly, ladies and gentlemen, is out of the bottle, and she's not going to go back in. Thank you very much.